Hi, everybody. I'm Suzanne Ross, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this second episode in our series, Raven Reviews, Election 2016. Our goal is to bring you some in-depth conversations about topics that maybe are being given short attention spans in mainstream media. We're going to be inviting some of our favorite thinkers to talk to us about issues of politics, religion, democracy, racism, and scapegoating. So we hope you will join us for upcoming interviews. Next week, we're going to be discussing the risks of tyranny in a democracy and terrorism with philosopher of ethics, Paul Dumochel. And this week, of course, we're discussing racism with our friend Melvin Bray, who I will be introducing you to shortly. So if you'd like to see how to participate in upcoming calls or to see recordings of our past calls, you just go to the Raven website, look on the sidebar, or click on events, and you'll find all you need. So today, it is my pleasure to be speaking with my friend Melvin Bray. How you doing, Melvin?
I'm doing well. How about yourself, Suzanne?
Pretty good. You're calling in from Atlanta, right?
Atlanta, Georgia. Yes, that's where my family and I have made our home. We tried to move away, and it kept calling us back, so we came back.
Yeah, home has a way of doing that. That's correct. Well, Melvin, I gave our talk today a title, and I'm calling it, Am I a Racist? Confronting Our Blind Spots. And the reason I gave it that title is that you, my friend, have changed the way I answer that question.
Wow.
You've opened up my awareness to some blind spots I wasn't aware of. And I have a feeling I've got a few more that maybe need to be dealt with. So this might be a little therapy session for me today. Who knows? But I'm really happy to have you here to talk with us. And I'm really happy we're recording it, because for those people who can't be here live, they can, I think, really benefit from the conversation. So, Melvin.
Well, I appreciate you inviting me, Suzanne, for sure.
Well,
and I know we have friends who would love to get in on the conversation. It being in the middle of the day may make that difficult, but yes, being able to access it after the fact will be great.
Will be great, yes, good. Well, Melvin, we're going to have your bio, posted with the interview, but just the recording, but just to introduce you by saying you're an Emmy Award-winning storyteller, a writer, an editor, an educator, and you've also been very instrumental in two festival events, if you will, that places I've met you, the Wild Goose Festival and at the Faith Forward gatherings. So, but you call yourself something that I'm not sure I've ever heard someone call themselves before, a social entrepreneur. And I wondered if you could tell us what that is and why you is one.
So social entrepreneurship is a thing, but it's not a language that has currency within faith circles a whole lot. It's perhaps developing more. What social entrepreneurship speaks to is this notion that a lot of people are out here taking risks in the effort to make money, but those risks to make profit don't have to be exclusive of purpose. And so social entrepreneurs go into the idea of starting a business in hopes of starting something that will speak to a critical need in the world, whether it be needs around ecological concerns, whether it be needs around how youth development, whether it be needs around how government, NGO work, you know, bringing electricity to places that don't have electricity, all these kinds of things, right? And so my kind of social entrepreneurship centers around the fact that I have a small consulting firm that works primarily with nonprofit organizations who are looking to do justice work in the world. And what I do is I do what's called design-based collaborative problem solving. And that's a long description for the fact that I seem to have a little bit of skill at putting people in the room and getting them involved in the right processes where they start to think creatively about innovation or about the problems they've been facing, intractable problems, and figure out that they already have the answers. They just didn't know how to talk to each other about it yet. Yeah. And so you know, we get them talking to each other about it, and they get to see those opportunities, and collaboratively, they come up with solutions to the things that matter to them most.
Wow. Well, I have seen you in a room, and you are an excellent facilitator. You do get people talking. You really do. And it is a wonderful experience rather than just being talked at and told what to do. Yeah. There's this feeling of discovery and excitement in the room when you're leading a project.
You know, for me, it's really it's a blessing to be in this space at this time in life, right? So right around 40, I was trying to figure out what's the next 20 years going to look like. And, you know, I have a certain set of skills, I guess, gifts that since childhood people thought were meant to push me out in front, you know, kind of working in front of groups of people and such. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I'm realizing is that the problems that we face today are problems that people who have been in traditionally power over positions aren't going to be able to solve, right? So they're not problems that white people, males, upper class folk, extremely educated folk are going to be the ones who are really going to be able to lead us out of. And so my goal now is to, like, how can I be in support of women, particularly women of color, particularly queer folk, who because of their unique kind of social positioning, are I believe, in best positioned and best experienced to help us deal with some of these intractable problems, to lead us as we deal with some of these intractable problems that face us now. Around sexism, heterosexism, racism, you know, these things.
Well, sure. I mean, you're talking about giving voice to people that haven't been part of the narrative of either what the problem is or how to solve it. So, yeah. You know, that's what brings us to that's coming out. It's in January, right? The publication.
Yes, it's coming out in January, and thank God that's not the cover, right? So we are we are just now settling on a better cover for the book entitled "Better: Waking Up to Who We Could Be," and
there is a place. Oh, you're hilarious. But see, that's why, you know, the publication and publishing process takes a while.
Yes.
To get going. But, yeah. You know, what you talk about in Better, I'm very pleased to have an advanced copy of it because it really, you're inviting us to tell better stories about our lived experiences together, but also about our faith stories and the way we've been passing on faith stories that in a way have been counterproductive, haven't been helping us solve problems.
That's exactly.
So, and especially, Melvin, you were very open and honest in discussing your experiences of being a Black man reading the Bible and of being a Black man in situations, in groups and gatherings and in America, what that's like. And so I wanted to talk with you about racism also in the context of the election as well. But before we dive into all those different areas, I was wondering if we could just sort of talk a little bit about just what is racism? How do we define it? Because I think, as you pointed out, sometimes we define it in ways that maybe let ourselves off the hook a little bit. So let's let you tell us. How do you think about that?
That's interesting. How I think about it. First, if I can, Suzanne, let me also clarify one thing previously, and that is that, like, the work, as I think about the work I do, it's really not about giving voice as much as it is about amplifying voice and supporting those who are stepping into their voice, who are using their voice, because, you know, like, part of it is me recognizing, like, the limits of my own power, right? And my agency, and encouraging people in their own agency, right? So in some weird way, that kind of relates to this question about racism, right? Because one of the things I think about is, like, I don't get to have my own definition of racism, right? Like, you know, that whatever our definition of racism is, it needs to be rooted in grounded in study in this field, right? And so there is a field regarding critical race theory, and that uses critical race theory. Critical race theory comes up in Black feminist political discussion. It comes up in all sorts of places across. But there's a field of study here, right? And basically, kind of a working definition, right? So first thing I'm going to do is encourage those who want to enter into this conversation. And if you enter into it, it's not about just entering it into it with your feelings. It's about entering into it with your own with a sense of curiosity, and taking the time to read and study those who've come before this thing and studied this thing deeply. Right. So, kind of the working definition I use, layman's definition, is that racism is a system. Right. And when I say system, I'm talking about a system of laws, a system of practices, economic structures, religious structures, all of a system that privileges, that whose purpose is to, or that's the purpose of which is to privilege white people, and just as importantly with the definition, to unprivilege people of color. Mm-hmm. Racism is a system, right? So to think about it like this. I was amazingly, two nights ago, my children decided to ask me what racism was.
Oh, did you?
Just totally unprovoked, right? And so, you know, I kind of give them that definition, but then I tried to make an analogy with them. I said, think about it like this. What part of the lawnmower cuts the grass? And so, of course, one of them went for, you know, the blade, right? Well, actually, the blade doesn't cut the grass. You can take a blade and you can lay it out there on the sidewalk and it's not going to do anything. And you can lay it on the grass, it's not going to do anything. And particularly if the blade's not sharp, right? So there's even a part of that part of the system that isn't even a part of the whole. It's an outside part that intervenes, right? And then one of my children said, well, it's the motor, right? It's the motor that does it. Well, no, you can take it out there. You can even put gas in that motor. You can start that motor, and it'll just sit there, right? It'll just sit there. And so you can add the housing to it. You can add the wheels to it. You can put the blade on the spindle on the bottom of the motor. You can make sure your spark plug is firing right. You can pull that thing. And even that whole thing humming on isn't going to cut grass because it requires some agency outside of itself even in operation, right? And so the system is the entirety of the thing working together. No one part actually commits the act of cutting the grass, just like no one part of our system necessarily commits the act of racial discrimination, right? But working in concert, the way the pieces work together, they create the racial discrimination. They privilege people of particular descent, and they unprivilege people of another descent. And then you have persons who are operating as agents or with agency within the system to carry out certain pieces of it. And so in that sense, that the system, like the lawnmower, right, is the lawnmower, but also the person who is the agent is the lawnmower, quite literally, too. And so when we use the term of racist, right, we're saying if you are a part of this system,
right,
and you participate in the privileging of yourself or in the unprivileging of others, whether intentionally or intentionally, then that makes you a part of the system, and so the terms that refer to the system refer to you too.
Right.
Right? So racist.
Right. That's where you really got me thinking, because the way you're talking about this, if you're benefiting somehow from the functioning of the system, and I thought, well, how the heck could I not be benefiting? I just by the accident of my birth and color and so forth, whether I choose or not choose to, I'm part of it. And so how do you think about that? You know, when I say, I'm asked the question, I am a racist, I quickly say, well, I don't want to be, you know, that's not my want to be. So what's a helpful way then to think about, not just throwing up your hands and say, well, there's nothing I can do because the system's there and I'm in it, you know?
Yeah, so there's a part of me that wants to think I have some answers to that question. There's another part of me that recognizes that, like, I just have a different experience on the other side of that system, right? Mm-hmm. And so, I'll make some observations, but, I wouldn't say, these are authoritatively the things, right? One thing to recognize is that racism is not about how you feel about a person.
Yeah.
So when people start talking about this being a racist system that is predicated on a philosophy of white supremacy and supported by structures like white objectivity, right? Then they are not saying you feel a certain way towards black people and that's your problem, right? It's not about that at all. It's about being involved in a process that is meant to privilege you in certain ways while it unprivileges other people in other ways, and how you feel about it doesn't affect that system.
Mm-hmm.
What affects the system is how you choose to be in relationship to it. Right? And so this is where we get into questions about dismantling racism, right? Dismantling whiteness, right? If the designation of the term white historically exists to privilege a particular group of people, it's to say you are not them, and therefore certain things belong to you.
Mm-hmm.
Certain things are all right for you. Certain ways of being in the world, no matter how hostile, still carry the blessing of our community, right? Mm-hmm. If the very term is meant to do that, right?
Yeah.
Then when we talk about anti-whiteness, right, or dismantling whiteness, right, mm-hmm. what we're saying is, hey, this thing is so deeply written that there's some things you're going to have to give up in order to be a part of what is becoming. And so that's why someone like Ta-Nehisi Coates would use language like those who believe themselves to be white, right? What he's saying is there's a particular choice to position yourself in this system that privileges some and unprivileges others. There's a particular choice that you make.
Yeah.
And there's a particular decision in it, and you can choose otherwise. It's also the reason that people of color can still participate in white supremacy, because they can make the choice
mm-hmm.
to hold and privilege particular notions about who we should be in the world, right? Versus they can choose another way, a more healthy way of being in the world that's not antagonistic to others, that's not hostile, that doesn't seek to rationalize immorality. You know, these kinds of things.
Yeah, that's really helpful, because I never, you know, really thought about whiteness as an identity that's been constructed and given to me, that it isn't something that just, you know, fell from heaven
like we can point to a point in history before people call themselves white.
Yeah.
And we can point to a point in history where whiteness became a thing.
Yeah.
And how it was used and why it was used. And then when it was actually, you know, initially, there was still a lot of delineation, even in our own laws here in the United States, between if you were white, male, and landed, had land, versus if you were anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can point to the discussions. Like, we can look at the discussions in books like A People's History of the United States. We can look at the discussions that were had that said, now, if we aren't careful, these poor white folk are going to unite with the enslaved black folk and the indigenous folk, and they're going to overthrow us.
Uh-huh.
So we need to create some designation here that gets poor white people to think of themselves, well, at least I'm not black,
mm-hmm.
right? Or at least I'm not Native American. And so then laws begin to be constructed, and social practices begin to be constructed, and even categories of employment begin to be constructed in order to create that designation of white, not rich, not landed, but at least not a person of color.
Right, right. So yeah, it is a question of identity and drawing those boundaries between who's in and who's out. And as you say, we can choose to accept all or none of an identity that's being handed to us. But you have to be aware that option is there, you know.